Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author Judy Battalion, whose new book is The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. She's joined in conversation by Catherine Lewis, Executive Director of the Museum of History and Holocaust Education and Professor of History at Kennesaw State University. And now join Catherine Lewis as she introduces Judy Battalion.
I'm so glad to see you join us. I'm Dr. Catherine Lewis, the Executive Director of the Museum of History and Holocaust Education, Professor of History at Kennesaw State University, and I'm going to be your host for tonight's program. I'm pleased to welcome you to this very special book festival in your living room event featuring New York Times bestselling author Judy Battalion. We're going to be discussing her amazing book, The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. It's been optioned by Steven Spielberg for a major motion picture. In this book, Judy recounts the story of brave Jewish women who became resistance fighters during World War II, a group of unknown heroes whose exploits have never been chronicled before. I know you're going to find this book as extraordinary as I did. Judy Battalion, as I said, is a New York Times bestselling author of this highly acclaimed book, The Light of Days, and her second book, White Walls, which was a memoir about motherhood, daughterhood, and the mess in between. I think a lot of us, that book would resonate with you. That has also been optioned by Warner Brothers. Judy has a BA in the history of science from Harvard and a PhD in the history of art from Courtauld University. University of London. And she's worked as a museum curator and a university lecturer. But when you read her whole bio, you'll see she's done so many different things. She was born in Montreal. She grew up speaking English, French, Hebrew, and Yiddish. And the Yiddish is going to come in quite handy in this project. She lives in New York City with her husband and three children. So let's welcome Judy to our book festival in your living room. Judy, it's great to see you. Great to see you again. Well, we're going to dive right in, Judy. We've done this before, so we're very excited. Impetus for the book. People always ask this question when you're on a book tour. Where does it come from? I know that you talk about it being kind of an accident while you were living in London 14 years ago. Could you tell us that story?
Absolutely. So this book began 14 years ago, and it did. It began by accident. I was living in London at the time, and it was a time in my life where I was thinking a lot about my Jewish identity. I am the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. I was thinking about what I call the emotional legacy of the Holocaust. How trauma passes over generations. I myself am a very anxious person, and everything at that time in my life especially felt very dangerous to me. And I started thinking about this. How much has my Holocaust heritage shaped how I was perceiving and reacting to danger? And that's what I set out to explore. I decided I was doing a lot of performing at the time. So I decided to write a performance piece, and I wanted to write about strong Jewish women who had confronted danger. And the first woman, I wanted to have a historical element to write about some real figures. And the first woman I thought of was someone I had studied in fifth grade. Her name was Chana Senesh. For those of you who don't know her, Chana Senesh was a Hungarian Jew, and she was young. She was about 20 years old. In the 1930s, she made Aliyah. She moved to what was then Palestine. She became a poet and a lyricist. Some of you may know her songs. But during World War II, she decided she wanted to fight back. She joined the Allied forces. She became a paratrooper
right.
and volunteered to return to Nazi-occupied Europe. She was caught actually very soon after she landed, but legend has it, she looked her executioners in the eye as they shot her. Mm-hmm. I grew up with Hannah Senish as a symbol of Jewish courage, as a hero figure. Mm-hmm. But back in 2007, I wasn't interested in Hannah Senish, the hero. I wanted to understand Hannah Senish, the person. Mm-hmm. Like, who does that? Who volunteers to return to fight the Nazis? What is the psychology? What is the personality behind mm-hmm. that audacity? What motivates that kind of boldness? That's what I was interested in. And so what I wanted to find was a nuanced biography of Hannah Senish, someone that really delved into the psychological, into her brain and her heart and her motivation. So I went to the British Library
right.
and I looked up Hannah Senish in the catalog. And frankly, there were not very many books about Hannah Senish at the British Library. So I just ordered whatever they had. And I went to pick up my stack of books. And one of these books I noticed was a little bit unusual. Mm-hmm. It was an old book. It was from the 40s. It was a dusty old book with a blue fabric cover and gold writing on the front. And it was in Yiddish. It was called Frauen in die Ghettos, Women in the Ghettos. But I always say even more unusual than the book is the fact that I speak Yiddish. So I was able to read it. And I started flipping through the book looking for Hannah Senish, but I couldn't find her. She was only in the last few pages. In front of her in this book was 150 pages of photographs and bios and obituaries and little snippets of stories of dozens and dozens of young Jewish women who fought the Nazis, and mostly who fought them from the Polish ghettos.
Right.
And the chapter titles were like ammunition, weapons, partisan combat. There was even written by a woman, an ode to guns. And I mean, this wow. was so, so different from any Holocaust narrative that I'd ever come across, that I'd ever grown up with, both in content and in tone. I knew right away that there was something, I knew I had to work on this. It was, there was some beshert, it was like a calling.
Right.
It kind of fell into my lap. And then there was a long process getting it into a book, but that is really how it began.
Well, and you never know where the spark is going to come from. Now, one thing that makes the book so extraordinary is that you really evoke the world of Polish Jewish women before the war, right? And give a sense of the richness of their lives. Then we get their wartime experience, and then for many, their post-war experience. Can you talk for just a moment about what that pre-war world was like for them?
So I've become actually totally obsessed with 1930s Poland.
Right.
So this could be a whole other Zoom session. It
might be another book.
I'm afraid it might be. So I'm going to try to control myself here.
Right.
But I became so interested in the 1930s because we don't talk about it very much. It's been forgotten, you know, it's been eclipsed by what happened
by the war,
of course.
Right.
Actually, 1930s Poland was a very rich time for Jewish culture. It was a golden era of, mm-hmm. I mean, there were 180 Jewish newspapers in Warsaw alone.
Right.
There was such cultural and political and linguistic and literary and theater and film. There was so much production mm-hmm. in this time. There was also growing anti-Semitism, both social and institutional, and Jewish communities were caught between, you know, feeling tremendous belonging and feeling that they didn't belong at
right.
the same time. So what was very interesting for me, again, I'll stop myself soon, but I think what I wanted to, especially in setting the picture of the story of these women who resisted, was that the women were what, in a way, I don't want to say feminist because they wouldn't have used the word feminist. So I'm imposing a contemporary sort of lens through which to view this, but the women were educated. Women, 45% of the Jewish workforce in 1931 was women. Women, Jewish Polish women worked. They worked outside the home. They went to school. Jews of university women went to university. The majority of women in Polish universities were Jewish women. Women had the vote in Poland in 1918. Right. It was before many Western countries. Women's fashion even had changed. Mm-hmm. They wore fitted blazers and, you know, low-heeled shoes, and their hair was cut short and worn in clips. And, you know, it was fashion in which they could walk, they could run, they could move. So I wanted to make people understand. I wanted to make my readers understand that this was a world where women were active and they worked and were educated and yes.
I think you're right. It's really in some ways a thrilling and unsettling period, but certainly Weimar, right, and New York City, and you could look at all these great centers, right? So Poland and Warsaw would have been like that, but you're right, it's totally eclipsed by the war. But you touched on something really important, I think, that is so central to the book, which is that Jewish women were not footnotes to the movement. They were central, the nerve center of the movement. Can you talk a little about that? And that certainly in some ways is the heart of the book.
Sure. So that's probably the answer you wanted me to give you before. And then I went off on my crazy story. So what I'm talking about in this book are underground organized resistance efforts. And they were organized by youth movements. And these youth movements started in the 1930s. They actually started before the 1930s, but in the 1930s in Poland, many young Jews, these are teens, early 20s, were members of youth movements. These were like the scouts, but more so. They were intellectual, social, emotional, physical, and spiritual training grounds for Jewish youth. And they were often affiliated with these different political parties, part of this cultural flourishing. There are many Jewish political parties. So the youth movements had particular values and politics. And the ones that I focus on in this book were socialist and secular youth movements. Some were Zionist, some were not. But these were youth movements because they were socialist and secular, they believed in egalitarianism and equality, and women had leadership roles in these youth movements. They were leaders of the movements before the war. Mm-hmm. Women also, you know, these youth movements were, because they were socialists, they believed in collaboration and collectivism. And many of these young Jews actually left their family homes and moved into communes or kibbutzim that were all across Poland. And they honed their values in these communes. And they learned to live together, to work together. They trained in Jewish pride in their heritage. They believed in self-sufficiency. They were agriculturalists. Mm-hmm. They did athletics and sports. And they also believed in psychology. Many of them had reading groups, they had psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. They talked about their strengths, their weaknesses. They talked about their interpersonal dynamics. Mm-hmm. So women were considered emotional leaders in many of these groups. Mm-hmm. They had equal positions to male leaders, and these groups really were these, I think, primed units of trust and camaraderie and communication that led them to become underground cells during the war.
Well, and I think that's what makes the book so extraordinary, is that you don't begin with the war, right? You lay that groundwork. So it helps explain How extraordinary these women are and where some of that came from, right? This milieu in which they've sort of emerged. And one other thing that's so interesting about the book is that gender so shapes their experience, right? They become resistance fighters, but they're sort of unexpected, right? So in what ways does gender give women both opportunity and disadvantage?
That's a great question. So, okay. I'm like gathering my thoughts. You can tell I have a lot to say.
There's so much, right?
So much to say. So gender, so women in the underground played particular roles often. And some of this had to do with the fact that it was that women, Jewish women, could work on the outside. That means they left the ghettos, which of course a Jew would be killed if they left the ghetto. So they left the ghettos by pretending to be Christian. And they carried out a lot of the underground work that had to be done on the outside of the ghettos, on the Aryan side, while pretending and performing Christianity. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it was easier for women to do this, or a few reasons, one of them is Jewish women were not circumcised. So if a man was on the outside and he was suspected of being Jewish, at gunpoint, he would be told to drop his pants. Mm-hmm. But of course, Jewish women didn't have that physical marker of Jewishness on their body. They didn't have that threat. Another reason is, and this is going back to my favorite 1930s, boys and girls in Poland in the 1930s, at school was mandatory up to eighth grade. Many Jewish families decided they would send their sons to private Jewish schools, but to save on tuition, they sent their daughters to Polish public school. Mm-hmm. This was their greatest gift later on. These Jewish girls who became these women in the underground were more assimilated. They were more acculturated. They had Christian friends. They were around, they knew of Catholic prayers.
Right.
They understood the mores, the habits, the mannerisms. Mm-hmm. So one woman writes about how she had to wear a muff when she went undercover because she couldn't even stop her hands. Right. They had an awareness of this. You glasses, very Jewish. Even to the detail of, you know, how many times a week you brushed your teeth, that was different in Polish families and in Jewish families. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of nuanced differences that women were just more aware of. But even more important is that in these Polish public schools, and they talk about this in all their memoirs, they were taught to speak Polish like a Pole.
Right.
Not with the creaky Yiddish accent. Mm-hmm. So women could communicate. They spoke the language. So even if a Jewish man had to do resistance work on the outside, he always brought a woman with him and she did the talking.
Right.
She bought the train tickets. She rented the room because her Polish was a more convincing Christian Polish.
Well, and polished, right, and gave her a kind of access. And I think that is such an extraordinary part of the story. And then, of course, the fact that no one would expect women to be resistance fighters, right, that just by their very gender, right, that there was no assumption that they would play that role.
Especially Nazi culture was classically sexist. So
they're
really like, why would a woman, why would a pretty young woman have a revolver inside a teddy bear?
Unexpected.
Right.
Well, we haven't even mentioned any of the women, and there are so many. Rania, of course, becomes one of your major characters, and you talk about her being an unlikely resistor. And I think reading from the book, you say, like so many Jewish women across the country, she did not think of herself as a political person. She was not part of an organization, yet here she was risking her life in action. You mentioned that many of the women were members of organizations, but not all. And so in some cases, ordinary women really shaped the war and the Holocaust.
Many of the women I talk about had been leaders in these youth movements before. And the movements I write about are socialist movements.
Right.
So they have these very strong socialist values, and they talk and write a lot about that.
You're listening to author Judy Battalion, whose new book is The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. She's joined in conversation by historian Catherine Lewis on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Renya, my central figure in the book, she was only 14 when the war started. So she was even too young, really, to have been part of the youth movements. And she herself wasn't a political person by nature. As self-described, she was pragmatic and savvy. And it just wasn't, that wasn't in her. Her sister was very political, but she wasn't. And I actually thought that that made her very relatable, especially to a contemporary audience. And to me, when I read her testimonies, she had the longest bit in that original book that I found.
Right.
And the other writings were filled with socialist philosophy and and espousing their ideals. And her writing was narrative, told the story of what happened in a very dramatic and active story. But the tone of it was almost had a witty turn of phrase almost. It was very matter of fact. And that made me relate to her. And I felt that a character like that was more relatable to a contemporary reader as well, rather than someone who was really espousing socialist theory.
Or driven by that ideology, which after a while, you know, you wouldn't get a sense of their day-to-day life in the way that you did with Renya.
Yeah.
But I also want to have you talk a little bit, Judy, about the fact that many of the women, because they could pass as Polish for all the reasons you just described, that many of them were jailed or arrested as Poles, not as Jews. How did that shape their experience?
Yeah, this was something I myself had never heard stories.
I hadn't either
about the war. So because these women were pretend, and Renya, I'll speak about Renya more. So I don't want to give away her whole story, but these women, they were pretending, they were performing Christianity. I mean, some of them 24 hours a day. They called it a you know, it was a life and death acting job. There was no intermission. They were afraid to sleep on a train or in any hostel or in any public place, because what if they mumbled in Yiddish or Hebrew? The need to perform, to maintain alertness, to maintain control was constant. So when these women were caught, many were, They were not even assumed to be Jewish. They were assumed, and this is Renya too, to be working for the Polish underground. They're often caught because they had, you know, very clearly counterfeit papers, or they were caught because they found weapons on them, or some of them were on wanted lists. But when they were caught, they were still performing, and they sustained and maintained these performances. Of course, they didn't want it to be known that they were Jewish. When Bella Chazan is caught on a train, I mean, an incredible story. She says she has to go to the bathroom. And the first thing she does, she had hidden Hebrew bulletins, underground bulletins. She had braided them in her hair. And that's when she's caught, the immediate thing is, I got to get this Hebrew out of my hair. And she puts it in the it wasn't even a toilet. And she covers it with dirt in the hole in the ground because they cannot know she's Jewish. And that's fun. And for her and for many of these women, they assume that they're part of the Polish resistance. So they are imprisoned in Polish political prisons. They are brutally tortured as the Gestapo try to get information from them about the Polish resistance. But these women, they don't break. They maintain this fictional identity, Bella, through camp, she goes to Auschwitz and she still is performing as a Christian, and she helps Jews at Auschwitz from her privileged point as
position,
a Polish
right.
prisoner.
Right. And it would have been very different, right? Their experience, brutal, you know, certainly just different. But it is extraordinary to think about that level of performance and their ability to do so. So let's talk for a moment. And you sort of make a distinction between kind of soft resistance, right? Informal acts of resistance. And then, of course, more formal acts like armed resistance. Both are quite extraordinary. And I think in your conversation, you talk about women caring for orphans, certainly helping in Auschwitz, right? In the way you just described, or creating libraries or saving documents. The continuum of resistance, as a historian, that's certainly something I think about a great deal. And I think you articulate that really quite brilliantly in the book and give a broad definition of what resistance is. Can you talk for a moment about that range of activities?
I mean, there was a huge range of rebellious activity, and I try to include examples from across the spectrum, though the book focuses on more organized resistance, physical resistance. I really try to include the broad range. And this does range from women running soup kitchens, underground secret schools, secret camps, secret sports leagues, printing underground bulletins, transporting underground bulletins. Even things like telling jokes during a transport to help relieve
humor,
building solidarity through humor, which was also illegal and outlawed, writing diaries, keeping diaries, hugging a barrack mate to keep her warm, mothers who went out and, you know, tried to do anything to find food for their children. People say, you know, having children, creating a Jewish child was not allowed. Giving birth was resistance. Staying alive was resistance. Mm-hmm. Hiding was resistance. Mm-hmm. Fleeing was resistance. The Nazis wanted all Jews dead. Anything against that was a form of resistance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you, for those of you who have read the book and bought the book, you'll see that it has so much depth and texture, and you really do come to know these women. But one thing that stood out to me that I think was really quite profound is you talk about this concept that not everybody survives the surviving. Right? And that the weight of history, and I think you opened with that, right? The weight of history and the weight of trauma and inherited trauma. And there were women, and there are certainly plenty of Holocaust survivors who survived the war physically and are defeated completely. There are suicides after the war. There are a whole host of things that happen. So this idea that not being able to survive the surviving.
The last section of the book, I should say, for people who haven't read it, is entirely post-war.
Right.
So I try to, I mean, many of these women were killed, but for those that did survive, I wanted to understand how they continued to survive, how they survived surviving. Did they survive surviving? There was one quote at the beginning of that section, from a woman who had stolen medical supplies at Auschwitz to help Jewish women. And she said, at liberation, we were now free from the fear of death, but we weren't free from the fear of life. And that really touched me in a way. These women had to, especially, I write about women, they were so young. I don't know if we stress that these were teenagers. These were 20-year-olds doing this resistance work. And when the war was over, they were 22 years old. They had nothing. They had no family, no nationality even, no home. Right. They were refugees. They were living in new countries. They didn't even speak the language. That, you know, they had missed that period in life when one trains for a career. They had missed, even when one often gets married or falls right. in love. Like that was the period of their life that was the war. So they had to start over at 23, 24 years old. And they, you know, I write about different women. So they're different stories. And some of them really stay involved in the survivor communities. And that's a big part of their coping, or what enables them to go on is being around people who share their experience. Some of them do the exact opposite. And they told me they didn't want to be a professional survivor. And they needed to start fresh. They write about mm-hmm. this. They say that they needed to completely start over. They couldn't, they that was so important to them. They had to move on. And others tried to move on and tried to start over and could not.
Couldn't.
And there are some right. tragic stories too.
Right. Well, and you took Rania's motto after the war, right? That it happened and it passed and that she moved through it. But you're right. I think because you give us so many different personal stories, we really come to understand the range of experience. And I think that's what makes the book so powerful. You have certainly central characters, right? But we certainly get a sense of a broad swath of Polish women and that experience. So there are beautiful photographs in the book. It's extraordinary that anything survived for historians to mine through, and certainly your experience at the British Library. But you also have these wonderful photographs. Can you talk about where they came from?
Oh, I loved finding the photographs. Yeah. They just, you know, I read most of their stories before I found any of these photographs, and then right. I would find them and just think, oh my good, they were so compelling, the photographs to me, because they look like me. I mean,
exactly.
when I was younger, but sure. you know, they look like I found many photographs of them in these youth movement in summer camps in the 1930s, and they look like they could have been taken in 1988 or 1998. I mean,
right.
it looks so modern and so mm-hmm. alive and fresh. And it really makes me feel a connection to right. women as well. I found these photographs in a number of archives. A very big source of the photographs was an archive called the Ghetto Fighters House.
Oh, it's a wonderful, a great archive.
And yeah. they have a lot of material from the resistance movement.
Right.
So they have a lot of, this is in Israel, it's in the north.
And quite a good museum.
Oh yeah, great
with it. Really good museum. Yeah.
A great museum, a beautiful museum.
Yeah.
And a library and archive. And so right. this was a huge source for me. Some came from Yad Vashem. Mm-hmm. Some came from the museum in DC, the U.S. Holocaust
right.
also has an amazing photo mm-hmm. collection. And some came from Poland. There are some interesting photos from mm-hmm. the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw.
Yes, yeah.
Very unusual photos, especially of Warsaw, of the ghetto of that
right.
time. Some were Nazi photographs.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nazis themselves documented, they called them the Jewish bandits. And they documented as they caught them in
right.
during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, they took a lot of photographs. Nazis famously had all kinds of, you know,
documentation
and yeah. media and propaganda. So, but they did have, I mean, the things they said about the photographs, I mean, obviously they're framed in a certain way, but the photographs themselves are quite interesting as well. And there are a number of photographs taken from the Nazis. It's in my book, I think I used one of their bunkers, the photo
as a photo
of the
right.
Jewish hideout. Those were taken by Nazis
right.
who found the hideouts after. And then I got things from some personal people and from some families and there were a few other smaller archives. It's all listed in the book too.
Well, but it's wonderful because you're reading along as you go through the book and you imagine these women, and then you get to the section with the photographs and you're right, presented with them in a very intimate sort of way. It really is a lovely addition to the book. So we're gonna start to shift a little bit. My last question before we go is actually a question that I'm going to ask in one way, but Norman Slosky, who posed the question in the Q&A, we're both kind of asking the same question. So Norman, I'm going to do a shout out for you. But I always ask when we're thinking about new work on the Holocaust, how it shaped the historiography. And Norman's question is related to that, maybe in some ways more detailed, that was your purpose, Judy, in writing this book to change the narrative of Jews in the Holocaust, instead of them going passively to their death, that Jews and others fought back successfully, valiantly, and courageously? So Norman, thank you for that question. And I think that sort of helps us think broadly about the historiography of Jews in the Holocaust.
I mean, that was certainly a big aim for me in writing this book. Mm-hmm. I mean, first, I was just fascinated by these stories that I'd never heard, but I was fascinated by them because they ran so counter to the myth of Jewish passivity that I myself had subconsciously
internalized,
yeah. And swallowed. I didn't even know that I had, but I had. And that's why when I found that Yiddish book and I'm reading these stories, not the content, the tone, this wasn't a sad book. This was a furious book. These were passionate writers who were fighting for freedom and for justice. And there were stories of activity and movement and life and running around Poland and jumping off trains.
Right.
And it was so different from the more staid, passive tone of Holocaust narratives that I was familiar with. And I too, my own family survived the Holocaust, but I too had imbibed this myth of passivity. And now when I look at the story of the Holocaust, certainly in Poland, I can't see it as it's a story of constant struggle, constant rebellion, constant revolt. Most people were killed because they were up against a sadistic, brutal military force. But that's doesn't mean they didn't struggle throughout every day.
Right. Right. Well, and I think, and again, thank you, Norman, for that question. Judy Schocken asks, has your book been translated into other languages like Polish or German?
It has been. It's going to be translated into about 20 languages. And the German translation, they're all coming out at different times,
right.
But it will be translated in Polish and into German.
Now you speak, of course, those languages. Are you playing any role in the translation or not?
Just the answering the many questions of like, what did you mean on page 37?
Exactly. Because translation's its own special skill.
Oh, yes. I don't speak Polish or German.
Right.
I speak Yiddish and Hebrew, but not
right. Polish and German. I'm not absolutely sure the name. I'm just reading from the email. But one question was, how much was the socialist ideology, right, in the U.S. shared with Golda Meir? I don't know that you can answer that, but there certainly was a great deal of socialist ideology here, right? You certainly saw it weave throughout a number of countries in this period. So I'm not sure I'm asking the question exactly how you're intending, but I do know that as you talked earlier, Judy, about socialism as being, sort of a powerful ideology in many of these youth groups and youth movements.
I mean, I was really focused on Poland in my study,
right.
So I can't really answer outside of that. But the largest Jewish political party in Poland was the Bund. This was more than a third of Polish Jews voted Bunds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bund was working class, came from Russia, actually, the original philosophy, and it was secular and, mm-hmm. and socialist. So it was certainly among Polish Jews, very, very widespread.
Present, right. Absolutely. And then Laurie Goldstein asks, of course, the Polish underground and resistance in Poland was well documented and certainly quite widespread. Can you talk about resistance networks in other countries? Did that play any role? Did the Polish resistance broaden out in any way? Or are you primarily focused on just Poland?
So when you say Polish resistance, do you mean the Jewish Polish resistance?
Well, because they're different ones. Right. You're absolutely right. They're completely different.
There are many resistance factions working in Poland alone.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is author Judy Battalion, whose new book is The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. She's joined in conversation by historian Catherine Lewis. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Poland itself had two large resistance armies. They called them the People's Army and the Home Army. And they fought with each other.
Exactly.
And one of them was communist, and one of them was nationalist, and one of them had a government running out of London.
Right.
And one was affiliated with Russia. And the Jewish underground also had so many different factions because of all these political parties.
That, of course, don't agree either.
And often they were collaborating with parts of the Polish underground and then fighting with them. And then they would switch allegiances and switch and switch and switch. So I that's like, this is another 4-hour Zoom.
And that's another book. Right. Absolutely.
On the relationships between all these various undergrounds.
Right. And this idea, I think people have this sense that there's a unified underground. And of course, that's not the case. But there were underground movements in France. There are underground movements in many of the occupied countries. I mean, that was not uncommon. Danish resistance is well documented. There are Dutch. There are plenty of resistance movements. But Poland, I often ask my students when I'm teaching my Holocaust class, if you had to choose a country to study for the Holocaust, what would you choose? And I always say there's no right answer, but the right answer actually is Poland, because that's really where the heart of the story is. And I think you sort of illustrate that. Okay, let's keep going. Naomi Marcus talks about, you focus on women in Poland. What about women in other countries of Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and France? Plenty of opportunity to, Judy, we're just giving you new ideas for new books at every turn. So Naomi wants to see your next four, right, in Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and France. But certainly women played significant roles in resistance movements, Jewish women and non-Jewish women broadly. But your focus is primarily Poland.
My focus is almost entirely Poland. I talk a little bit about Slovakia because one of my figures goes there, and there was a woman who was very involved in the resistance, a Jewish woman, was one of the leaders of the resistance. So I do just give a little bit of information about that. But the book really is focused on Poland.
Poland, right. And Sue Burge asks the question. She just wants to remind the audience the name of the ghetto fighters, the museum in Israel. She just wanted us to say that one more time so
this
she would know.
The Ghetto Fighters House is what I was talking about. But there are a number of museums and archives that focus on the resistance in Israel. And they're all listed. I have an extensive bibliography, and in the archive section, they're all there because each of these different groups that I was talking about. They each have their own archive. They each have their own library. They're still not getting along. They still have different stories about what happened in the Morsagato Uprising. So there are a number of different archives.
Right.
I just happened to get a lot of information from the Ghetto Fighters House, but I also visited other archives too, and they're all listed in the book.
And Ronnie Rose asks, are there areas of any places in Poland where Jewish resistance women are honored, statues, you know, any kind of public recognition of these women?
So there are in Warsaw, there are memorials to resistance fighters in several locations, and the women who are involved are listed on those memorials. And is as part of a public education, public art project, there are certain sculptures dedicated to specific people. And one of them is dedicated to this woman, Frumka Plodnicka, who was a leader of the Jewish community, a leader of the Jewish underground, even was awarded a Polish military medal after the war. And we've forgotten about her somehow. So there is recently a monument to her. I wrote an article about, I don't know, 6 weeks ago for the New York Times about some of these women. And there's been some press in Poland around it.
Right.
And one of the suggestions was Nusia Teitelbaum. She was an assassin. She killed. They were saying, why don't we make a monument for her too?
Right.
So who knows? Maybe we'll see more.
Well, and I think you've done such an extraordinary job of uncovering these stories that I predict that conversation will simply continue. So Marlene asks, did you run into any obstacles doing your research in Poland? And thank you for your work.
Thank you. I mean, not really. The only obstacle, I tracked down my central character's childhood home, I think.
Right.
And I wanted to try to go inside and see, and I was not invited inside. That conversation, but she said, this isn't the right house. You have the wrong address. I don't know. Maybe she was right. Maybe not. So that's like one small example, but I found, you know, I had amazing help in Poland, actually. Mm. Pauline Museum is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
The Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw is incredible. There's a lot of historical work around the Holocaust in Poland, and a community of scholars and translators and literary folk and young people who are very interested in these stories and in the Holocaust. So that's the world I was in. Mm-hmm. So I didn't find any real obstacles.
Well, and when you all read the epilogue of Judy's book, in some ways the epilogue is a book within itself. Almost a travelogue about sort of following the families, the thread of the family stories and meeting the people. I don't want to give it away because it really is quite an extraordinary story within that. But you certainly do get a sense of the challenge of kind of tapping into that history and uncovering it.
The obstacles I had, now I have the answer, were a bit more having to do with language. It was not with particular people or politics. It was, I was working on a project that covered so many languages, some of which I don't speak, and none of them were English. So,
right.
I, and many of these women had so many names. They had Hebrew names and Polish names,
right,
and Yiddish names and 25 Yiddish nicknames. And in the war, they used wartime names. They had fake names from their IDs and their Polish identities.
Sure.
And then to leave Europe, they would have to pretend to be married to get immigration papers. So they changed their names. Then they would go to a new country and they would change their name to fit in with the country. And then they would actually get married and they changed their name. So these were, and I'm looking at all these Hebrew, Yiddish, Polish names in English search engines generally, trying to figure out the right spelling and the right, you know, and this was complicated. I would spend a whole day trying to figure out if Astrid was the same as Estrit, was the same as just the letter A. Sometimes people didn't use names in their testimonies because they didn't, this was right. The underground. They didn't want to get caught. They didn't want anyone to get caught. That things written close to 44, 45, they were still fresh. So I had to, you know, that was actually very complicated.
Be creative about it. Absolutely. Yeah. Now I know we're coming toward the end, and we've got a few more questions. I want to make sure we get to them. Faber Lynn asks a question. Do I understand correctly that your book is a true story? Is it historical fiction? And Faye, I completely understand why you ask that, because it is so extraordinary that it really could be historical fiction. And that sort of connects to the next question by Roberta Rich about how did the book come to the attention of Steven Spielberg?
Okay, so the book is absolutely nonfiction. There are 65 pages of footnotes at the end. You don't need to read them, but I really wanted to show where I got every bit of information and every story. And they also highlight, sometimes I found different accounts. I was working from testimonies. I was working from personal stories. And sometimes there were conflicting accounts. And I address that in the end notes and try to explain that there are other options and maybe why I chose a certain one. But it's definitely nonfiction. And Steven Spielberg, this was when the book sold, his company, he heard about it. This was a while back. And so they were interested and they optioned it right from the get-go.
Right. Now, we're probably not going to get every question, but I do want to do a shout out for everyone who put one in. Naomi Marcus talked about interaction between the Polish and the Jewish-Polish resistance movement. So Naomi, I'm simply going to urge you to read the book because that's in some ways the heart of it. But Barbara Roven says, how did all the pictures survive? And I know, Judy, you talk a fair amount about that. So as you read through the book, you'll get that. But Ellen Schenfeld asks, who wrote the Yiddish book that sparked the interest, the one you found in the British Library?
Yeah, so that was So it turned out, I didn't even understand this at first. That was a book, it was an edited collection, but it was almost more like a scrapbook.
Right.
And it was edited and put together and translated into Yiddish by someone named Leib Spitzman, who was a historian of labor Zionism. He was a survivor himself. He was based in New York. And what he did in 1946 is he took many sources that were published in Hebrew in Palestine at the time. These were obituary notices. These were snippets of personal testimonies. These were essays written by survivors. And he exerted them and translated them into Yiddish in order to tell American Jews what these young women had done in the war and to tell them of the incredible bravery and feats of these young Jewish women. Mm-hmm. So yes, I hope that it was published in 1946 in New York.
So we're coming to the end, but I just want to say thank you to Pam for giving the extra information about the Ghetto Fighters Museum. And there are additional questions from Howard Fagan about women resistors at Auschwitz, like Rosa Ribota. Not a question, but a comment. I'm so glad to hear there's recognition of Jews in Poland. And then, of course, Marlene saying, I'm glad to hear that your experience with research was a positive one. My parents were Polish Jews who survived Auschwitz. Thank you so much. So thank you to everybody. We could go on, Judy, with you another hour. I know we could, but I will strongly urge you to read Judy's book. But mostly I want to thank you, Judy, for your time and to all of you for joining us. So thank you again for doing that. More exciting book festival in your living room events are coming, including an event with Senator Amy Klobuchar. And again, on behalf of the Marcus JCC. Judy, we cannot thank you enough. And we're just so delighted that the book is getting all this attention. I'm often on NPR and I'll hear you or open the Times and see you. It's an important book. It matters a great deal. And we're all so
Vina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author Judy Battalion, whose new book is The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghettos. She was joined in conversation by historian Catherine Lewis, executive director of the Museum of History and Holocaust Education and professor of history at Kennesaw State University. On the next edition of Bina, our guest will be the senior U.S. Senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, whose new book is Antitrust, Taking on Monopoly Power from the Gilded Age to the Digital Age. Here's a preview.
And I worked in the private sector for almost 15 years representing companies. I believe in healthy capitalism. It was Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, who warned of the unbridled power of the what he called the army of monopolies. And so that's what, if you believe in small business capitalism, you can't just say, oh, let's just let the big guys dominate and we're not going to have any laws in place and rules of the game. And the other industries outside of tech, online travel, you think you're getting a good deal, you go to all those things, check it out. 90% of them are owned by just two companies. There's consolidation in sunglasses. There's consolidation in cat food to caskets. John Oliver did a funny bit on this for a half an hour about all the consolidation. And he ended by saying, if you are tired of all this consolidation and it makes you want to die, good luck, because there's only three casket makers left. And he looked up the name of them. Well, actually, one has bought the other. So then now there's only two. And so that's why, we had a healthcare consolidation hearing today with Senator Lee. And when you get to the Republican support on this, I had a real breakthrough last week on a bipartisan vote. Senator Grassley, Chuck Grassley and I, who's a bit of a maverick, we passed our bill to greatly increase the fees that are charged on mergers to give the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, now led by Merrick Garland, who has a firm understanding of antitrust law, to give them over $120 million more dollars to hire lawyers, because you cannot take on the biggest companies the world has ever known with duct tapes and Band-Aid. And we did that bipartisan. And there's a whole number of Republicans now that are coming over to this. It's not just about...
Are they really? Okay, so there are Republicans getting on board, huh?
There are. Now, I want to do... I first get the agency strong enough. That's what this bill is. And then we have to do some appropriations at the end of the year. Secondly, change the law so it's easier to take these merger cases on, and also to look back at big consolidation like they did with AT&T and unwind some of this or divest assets. You're not going to destroy and blow up the companies. You're simply going to say, well, WhatsApp, Instagram, wait a minute, Facebook bought them. In the words of Mark Zuckerberg, his own email, because we'd rather buy than compete. Problem under the antitrust laws. And so you can unwind some of that. And then so those are the two things. So the bills right now, those bills, my one big bill is Democratic, but there is Republican interest in pieces of it. And so that's what I'm working on as well.
That was the U.S. Senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, who will be our guest on the next edition of Bina. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rosh Hashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.